Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all, but we have some special students that I want to introduce and welcome on behalf of the court. We have Luxembourg Go School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have Gateway Technical School. Would those students please stand? We have Little Shoot High School. Would those students please stand? And welcome to you. You may be seated. And Ripon College with Attorney Sorensen. Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. The high school students have come with a national award-winning program that the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin sponsor. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, they get material about the case and come. And they ordinarily are here in the morning and meet with a justice. Did the Luxembourg Casco School and Little Shoot, were you here in time for the noon session? Yes or no? Those who say yes, raise your hands.
Some do.
I can do. So some of you were here. We always welcome students from the technical school and from Ripon College. They're both repeat players in that they come here with some frequency. And we even have a graduate of Ripon College, Justice Gableman. And I think Justice Wilcox was a graduate of Ripon also. So they are especially welcome. If any of the students are able to stay after this oral argument, we can provide Justices Crooks and Gableman to talk with them briefly about the procedures of the court. So just remain here if you can. Everyone else is invited to join the students. The discussion will be on procedure, not on the substantive issues of this case. We'll turn now to the case, and let me read the order of appearances so that we're all on the same agenda. I'm now calling 07AP1754 Hocking versus Dodgeville. Having 25 minutes to present their side is Christopher Stumbaum. And then Attorney Tuckweiler will represent Charles O'Rourke for 10 minutes. Attorney Epstein, Patricia Epstein, will represent Charles O'Rourke for 10 minutes. And Rick Munt, Attorney Munt, will represent Amy Kubau Schrenk for 10 minutes. That will add up to 30. And then Attorney Stumbaugh gets his 15 minutes in rebuttal. We are all in agreement? Okay. So we will first hear from Attorney Christopher Stumbaugh. I would just one thing. If anyone would like a summary of this case, that you don't have one, if you'd raise your hand, we'd be happy to give you one. All right, thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christopher Stumbaugh, and my associate Tyler Keeler and I represent Glenn and Luann Hocking. I will be arguing the merits of our case in a rebuttal. My argument today deals with two primary issues. The first issue is whether the application of Milwaukee Metro represents an expansion of Wisconsin nuisance law under the facts of this case. The second issue is whether it was appropriate for the circuit court to grant summary judgment on duty and nuisance and negligence grounds, and whether public policy should prevent liability under these facts.
Imagine what are those questions, court counsel, with the certified questions of the Court of Appeals here?
Your Honor, with Justice Bradley, with respect to that, it was our understanding that all the issues were taken up on appeal, as well as a certified question on public policy.
What do you, well, the certification starts with, can an uphill landowner who has done nothing to affect surface water flow be held liable to the owner's downhill neighbors for damages and injuries sustained as a result of the water flow? That was one of the certified questions. And which of the issues that you've set forth addresses that question, or do they all, and if so, how?
Well, they are interrelated, Justice Bradley, but primarily it would be the expansion of Wisconsin law allegations that we're dealing with, but that is it. Primarily, it's the first one.
Okay, repeat the first question, please.
The first issue that I... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first issue is whether the application of the Milwaukee Metropolitan case represents an expansion of Wisconsin nuisance law under the facts of this case.
Before you continue, because I normally don't like to interrupt someone just after they've started, but you're stating the issues, and of course the issues in some ways kind of paint the umbrella for the rest of our next hour here. And the Court of Appeals, I read to you the first sentence of their certification. The second sentence of the certification is, it may be necessary to decide whether or not Milwaukee reasonable, whether the Milwaukee case in some ways, I think, conflicts or with Dietz or compares it to Dietz. Is that what you're intending with your expansion language? I mean, I want you to hit the certified question.
Certainly, and my argument clearly will with respect to the duties and obligations of the uphill landowners versus the downhill.
Okay. Does Milwaukee Metropolitan conflict with Dietz?
No, we do not believe it conflicts with Dietz because Dietz merely established the reasonable use doctrine in Wisconsin. However, historically, and I would ask that we imagine a younger Wisconsin, a land of rolling hills and small farms and neighbors with property lines and water flowing across those lines, and you will have 150 years later the same situation we have here. As we cite in our main brief, the basic facts of this type of issue have not changed, and neither has the basic law which governs it, despite the adoption of the reasonable use doctrine. From the Cobb decision in 1875, through the Ramsdale decision in 1882, through Brown versus Milwaukee Terminal Railway in 1929, to the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage case of 2005, we see a clear and unbroken line of case law indicating that individuals who purchase property on which there is a nuisance will be responsible for harms and losses done as a result of the continuation of that nuisance, even where that nuisance was not created by them. Not only this, but our historic case law finds that the successor to the title and possession of property who omits to abate a nuisance erected thereon by another is liable for the damages caused by it. The action being for damages resulting from the continuation of the nuisance as well as for its erection is sufficient to show that the injury was caused by the authority of the defendants or that having acquired title to land after the nuisance is erected, they have continued it. Well, based on the arguments of the defendants and the respondents here, and their friends, it would appear that such language was authored by the plaintiffs in our brief. But actually, this language was authored by this court more than a century ago. In reality, they are not fighting the expansion of nuisance law in Wisconsin. They are fighting the application of nuisance law in Wisconsin, which has stood nearly since the time of statehood. The Brown case is instructive because it's cited actually by both parties. I'm referring especially to the Aurorics. In this case, they cited along with Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage case.
Counsel, the portion of the case that you just quoted relates to causation, and it indicates that one should be stopped from allowing something that he or she has caused. What have the uphill landowners in this case done to cause the defect with the water?
Well, in the second case that I cited, Justice Gableman, Ramsdale, it sets forth the law since 1882 in Wisconsin that every continuation of a nuisance is, in fact, a new nuisance. So what we have here is a restarting again and again with respect to the same situation.
But doesn't that relate to one who has actually taken some affirmative step to cause the nuisance?
Actually, we would indicate that the case law with respect to the Cobb case and with respect to the Brown case, and which was 80 years ago, and with respect to the Ramsdale case, it is the continuation issue. These people were not the creators of the initial nuisance. They are people who acquired title later and didn't address it. But they are not the people who started the problem. So
what is the duty of the uphill landowners in your estimation?
Well, the duty of the uphill landowners in our estimation, Justice, is simply to use ordinary care to discover what is on their property. This is a very simple negligence issue. And that duty of ordinary care, as we cite in our brief, through this case, this court's decision in Alvarado, is that landowners, like everyone else in Wisconsin, owe a duty of reasonable care to the world, to act reasonably under the circumstances. Reasonableness is always going to be a question for the fact finder. It's inappropriate for summary judgment on that basis alone.
Are there any facts in the record to indicate that the respondents were aware of the water?
Particularly with respect to the O'Rourke's, they were alerted very very quickly after they took ownership by Mr. Hocking of a problem that was existing. With respect to Ms. Krubosch-Schrank and her tenure of ownership, the issue is not their actual awareness, but should they have been aware. This case, this court makes clear in the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage case that the issue is creation, the issue can be maintenance, and it can also be, did they use reasonable care to discover, or did they know, or should they have known, is really the question. And under the facts that we have here, the creation of a swamp necessarily in your next door neighbor's yard is something that should be observable.
Counselor, unless I misunderstand the facts, all of the water that was causing problems to your clients didn't just arise on the defendant's property, but rather flowed from people further up the hill from the defendants over their property and collectively pooled on your client's property, correct?
Well, that is the physics of it, Justice Roggenstein. What we have is a situation where water is both landing on the O'Rourke's property, water is being transmitted by gravity, which is their water, and in addition to other people's water. But the causation issue doesn't occur until it's going on to our property through the O'Rourke's.
I understand, but all of the water is not water that initially hits for the first time on the defendant's property. Some of the water that's damaging your client's property came from those folks further up the hill, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. So what duty do the defendants have to keep water that's coming from someone else off of your client's property?
Well, the duty is to act reasonably under the circumstances with respect to abatement. Now, what they need to do is abate. Abate doesn't mean solve the entire problem. It means to take reasonable steps under the circumstances to avoid it. It could be these both properties are next to a street, for example. There is a property line that goes right up to the curb, and then there's the street. They could have moved more of that water off onto the street from that was coming on their property. But what happened here was that an incredible increase in elevation took place between the two properties, which meant that this was the final stopping point before the deluge for Mr. and Mrs.
Your clients are at the bottom of the hill, so obviously the person second up from the bottom is going to be the final stopping point before it gets to your client. You know, this, as I understand it, the subdivision was developed with no storm sewers, which is essentially the problem that everybody is stuck with now. Isn't there any other remedy to local municipalities to do a special assessment or something and put in storm sewers? Why are we here before us? I mean, certainly the defendants are not going to put storm sewers in for the whole neighborhood.
Neither is a storm sewer necessarily required to abate a nuisance. But we have...
But this nuisance. We're talking about this nuisance. What do you think is necessary to abate it?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. What I'm talking about is to abate this nuisance, they needed to move water that was coming onto to our property from their property and have it exit their property in a different way. Now, what we're talking about is whether the city of Dodgeville should have taken certain actions. We can't control that elective process at all.
Well, you sued them too late, correct?
Well, that is an issue. That is actually another appeal which is happening right now. And the basis for the filing in that case had to do with their promises to take care of it. So ultimately, we have a situation where the nuisance is still abatable, and it's coming from the source, which is the O'Rourke's.
Well, they maybe are part of the source, but they're not all of the source. Should they sue the people then uphill from them for creating a nuisance to them because they've got water running off of their property onto the defendant's property? We should have like this chain of nuisances?
Well, it may be a chain, but it's not the lengthy chain that has been alleged here. We have a discrete area with just several people in a row. So with respect to that, if they believe that they've been harmed by the action of their upserving or their superior landowners, that would be an issue for them to take up. But clearly, they may have a right of contribution against the city of Dodgeville, which still exists today, with respect to it. So because of how this...
Well, that's certainly not a question that's before us. So just as I read this, it seemed like there should be a practical solution to the problem your clients are having outside of a court action, but maybe not.
Well, they certainly tried working with the city for many years, and that's the subject of the other appeal.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, in response to Justice Rodensack, you indicated the duty is the duty to act reasonably under the circumstances, the duty to exercise due care under the circumstances. Your expert, I believe, indicated that there were three means of alleviating the problem. This is a follow-up to Justice Rodensack's question.
Yes.
And one was to install storm sewers to collect excess storm water and pipe it underground. Another was to construct detention ponds. And another is to provide the Hocking property with a storm water collection and drainage system. Is that reasonable under the circumstances to have the defendants engage in that kind of abating?
The defendants in this appeal, Your Honor?
Yes.
No. The issue with respect to those recommendations had to do with a request by the city of Dodgeville on this expert to see what the city could do under those circumstances.
Well, the duty is to, as you say, to act reasonably under the circumstances to abate. What are you asserting is what the defendants should do in acting reasonably under the circumstances to abate?
Well, Justice Bradley, I really wish we would have had an opportunity to reach those issues in any sort of finality in the circuit court level, because what happened is the plaintiff hasn't even been deposed in this case. This case came up on appeal at a very premature level. Our expert had not been deposed in this case. With respect to what these landowners could do, they could take steps to abate with respect to channeling that water, maybe onto the street, because that would have been the most sensible thing without having to do this, and have the city of Dodgeville cooperate with that. But ultimately, this was a situation where we have, for example, the recommendations by the expert had to do with the city taking absolute steps to absolutely cure the problem. Abatement, it calls for something less than that, which is doing what you can to keep this from happening. It is well settled with respect to Wisconsin law that continuation of a nuisance, even if created by another, is still a nuisance. And that brings us to the Milwaukee Metropolitan case. It's important because it establishes the basic formulation for private nuisances, which of course is an interference with the use and enjoyment of land. After that, we look at Restatement Second of Torts, Section 822, in the Crest case. After it's been established that a nuisance in fact exists, the next step in a nuisance analysis is determining whether there is any liability-forming conduct. And proof of the underlying tortious conduct is an essential element of that.
Doesn't it depend upon what kind of a nuisance you have as to
analysis you do in trying to determine liability or the lack thereof for it?
For clarification, what type of nuisance?
Well, this is a nuisance that's created by groundwater that comes from rain, falls on the defendant's property and elsewhere, and eventually a whole bunch of it ends up on your client's property, causing them damage.
Okay.
Now, if it were a different kind of nuisance, a factory that gives off very obnoxious odors, then you might have a different test that you apply. But this is a nuisance that involves groundwater, and my question to you is, because it's that particular kind of a nuisance, does the way you analyze it differ from one that, say, is a smell, a bad smell? There's a cannery next door, and it gives off really bad smells.
Well, I think, as this court noted and cited the Brown case in the Milwaukee Metro, certain activities of commerce will be considered nuisance even without negligence, and that's one of them, the tannery example. However, I don't believe that the analysis is fundamentally different. You are looking at the same sort of ordinary care. What do they need to do under the circumstances? Because each nuisance will have a different kind of abatement. We certainly can agree about that. But the issue is whether they act reasonably upon knowing what the issue is, or upon whether they should have known what the issue is, to address it and to try to fix a problem or to try to discuss it with plaintiffs or with the city. I mean, this is perhaps a multilateral situation on the abatement end, but it's certainly something that has to be done. So with respect to it, I don't think that the analysis changes at all. It's still, did they act reasonably under the circumstances? The only difference would be if there's a special statutory scheme dealing with, for example, tanneries or environmental issues, that would have something to do with it. But this is basic nuisance law, and we believe that they would have to act reasonably under the circumstances.
Well, let me put it to you a little bit differently. You are familiar with the reasonable use doctrine for groundwater flowage that creates a nuisance to somebody, generally someone like your clients who are kind of at the bottom of the hill, right? Okay. And then you've talked to us a little bit about Milwaukee Metro, and that was also water, but it was a broken water main that leaked for a while until it got big enough that it collapsed the city sewer, and we don't know exactly when the whole thing broke. The analysis that was applied in Milwaukee Metro was a negligence analysis. Nuisance was the injury, so to speak, but the cause was alleged to be negligence in that case. Okay. When we have had cases that look at reasonable use, generally you're talking about the people conduct is intentional conduct. So you're not saying they were negligent in living on their property, cutting their grass, and so forth. What you're saying is, was their conduct, intentional conduct, a reasonable use of their property? So my question to you is, are we here to apply an analysis that looks at the intentional conduct of the defendants, or are we to apply a negligence analysis or some other analysis to the conduct of the defendant, and why would you choose whatever one you choose?
Okay. This is definitely part of the analysis that this court underwent in the Milwaukee Metro case.
Mm-hmm.
It looked at intentional violations or intentional nuisances, and it looked at negligence. And
it wasn't an intentional violation. It was intentional conduct that ended up giving rise to a nuisance, but there wasn't any intent to cause the nuisance.
Certainly, and in fact, this court noted that it couldn't have made that decision in 19. The defendant in that case could not have made that decision in 1926 or something. But ultimately, the question, it has to do with the pleading, and it has to do with the with what the claims are and the proof which has been established. The claim here has to do with negligence ultimately, because that is the type of nuisance that we are dealing with.
Why?
Well, because it has to do with ordinary care on the part of these defendants. It could have been, you could argue that it was intentional with respect to the creators if they knew, or actually if they absolutely.
Yeah, I think you misperceive the conduct that's either intentional or negligent. Reasonable use of someone's property is something they intentionally do. Okay, they don't negligently live in their house. I guess one of these folks made a garden in their property. I mean, they did it on purpose. Now, they didn't on purpose try to harm your client or create a nuisance. So I think the focus is not on
intentionally trying to create a nuisance, but whether the conduct that you're saying is wrongful was intentional conduct, or whether, as was our analysis in Milwaukee Metro, there was nothing to show they knew that the line was leaking. And then there were allegations, well, they should have tested the lines. If they tested the lines, they would have known that they were having problems. Milwaukee is really bad because they only repair water pipes after they've broken. They got a bunch of old pipes. And there were pressure analysis. All those things were allegations of negligent conduct, okay, that caused, alleged to have caused this nuisance. And my question to you here is, are you alleging negligent conduct? It appears from your pleadings you are. Why? I mean, what did they do that was negligent? You're saying, well, they didn't abate the nuisance. If that's the wrong place to look, they've got to do something that's wrongful, and I guess I want to know kind of what it is you're hanging your hat on.
Well, what we're hanging our hat on, with respect to the conduct of the defendants that we're talking about here, is the fact that they knew or should have known that their property was being used to flood the plaintiff's property.
They weren't doing anything on their property. They just went in their house and shut the door and had dinner. I mean, I don't know, what did they do? In Milwaukee Metro, you can say the pipes were leaking and they, A, didn't test the pipes, or B, they didn't do pressure tests, or a lot of different things. And to me, their conduct, frankly, seems intentional. I mean, they went in their house, they used their house. Well, the conduct can be intentional. I'm driving down the road at 75 miles an hour. That's intentional. I know I'm driving 75 miles. It's intentional.
Anytime you drive 75, it could be a nuisance.
That's right. Each time I drive, it's a nuisance. That's another issue, which we won't go into.
You do have a right to remain silent.
Exactly. Oh, my time is intentional. I hit somebody. I have no intention of hitting them. So it's the fact that I hit them is negligence because I have not taken appropriate steps to protect people. And it's negligent because it's negligent to drive, per se, over the speed limit. Okay. Is there a duty here when your clients, is it a duty to your clients that somebody do something with their property even though they didn't initiate the problem, right? They didn't build the hill, right?
Absolutely.
They bought the house with the hill on it, right?
That's right.
And your position is they have a duty to do something with that hill if that hill is creating a nuisance for somebody else. Is that your position?
That is absolutely our position.
And the failure to do something to the hill to correct the nuisance is negligent conduct.
Absolutely.
Because they don't intend to harm the guy down the hill, right?
No, there's no evidence of that.
And you can have a nuisance either intentional or negligent, right?
Yes.
And that's your position, as I understand it, is a negligence.
It is.
So why'd you lose below?
So why did we lose below?
Mm-hmm.
With respect
What's
to that.
What's the kicker? What's the kicker issue here that makes you lose, made you lose below? Then we didn't talk about why you should or shouldn't win or lose here.
The kicker issue below was that the circuit court believed that there was no duty with respect to landowners who acquire title to property to act reasonably when they know or should know that they're creating a nuisance.
So where do you find a duty?
The duty is found in the basic negligence and nuisance law of Wisconsin, established more than a century ago, with respect to how neighbors deal with their other neighbors when they know or come into a nuisance. And two of those cases were water cases.
Mm-hmm.
So this is nothing new and nothing extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It's just a rough, and I see that my time is up.
Well, you should finish your response.
It's a reaffirmation of the Wisconsin nuisance law as it has always existed with respect to this type of thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Tutwiler? Ms.
May it please the court, my name is Amy Tutwiler. I, with my co-counsel Patricia Epstein, are representing Charles and Jones O'Rourke and American Family Mutual Insurance Company in this matter. I will address the applicability of the surface water reasonable use doctrine, principles of nuisance, and the restatement section of torts, section 839. Ms. Epstein will address the interplay between the concepts of duty and public policy, and will explain the public policy considerations that apply in this case. Attorney Rick Mont, representing defendant respondent Amy Krubosch-Schrenk, will address the court after Ms. Epstein. Appellant would have this court create a cause of action where none exists today. The mere ownership of land up gradient of another's does not and should not create a claim for liability for surface water. Moreover, the long-established reasonable use doctrine supplements, that is, complements, and does not conflict with nuisance principles in Section 839. But as it happens in this case, plaintiff does not meet the elements for making either a nuisance claim or a claim under Section 839.
What are the elements, and I'm looking at jury instruction 1920, what are the elements for a private nuisance negligent claim? First of all, let's get this clear. Do you agree that the theory upon which this case is being advanced is negligence as opposed to intentional conduct?
I do, Your Honor.
And do you agree that we're dealing with a private nuisance and not a public nuisance?
I do.
Okay, so we're now dealing with a private nuisance negligent conduct. Okay.
Yeah,
so
yes,
what are the elements?
The elements, and I hope I have them all here, the first is to prove that there is a nuisance condition. That is a condition that unreasonably interferes with the private use and enjoyment of the property.
Is that adopting Restatement 833, Restatement Torts 833, defining nuisance?
I believe so. Secondly, and it's a separate and distinct requirement, you also have to prove that there's liability for the nuisance. In other words, you can have a nuisance that's not actionable if there's not tortious conduct underlying.
And here the tortious conduct is that's alleged is negligence.
Is negligence, correct. And Milwaukee Met clarified, Your Honor, that if you're claiming that the tortious conduct at issue is a failure to act, then there must also be proof that there's an affirmative duty to act. So in other words, and our point is that you look to the reasonable use doctrine to define that standard of care, to tell us what, in fact, is the duty or absence of duty, as it were. And then if those elements are met, I think you have to prove damages. This I don't have before me.
Close enough. Now, your opposing counsel says there is here a duty to act reasonably under the circumstances to abate the nuisance. Do you agree with that statement or disagree?
I disagree with that statement with regard to our clients because the facts are clear, obviously undisputed, and part of the question of certification that our clients did absolutely nothing to cause the problem.
I'm not yet, in my mind, at the application of the rule or the principle. I'm still trying to discuss kind of up here about the principles. Do you agree that a duty, regardless of whose client is involved, that the duty is to act reasonably under the circumstances to abate a nuisance?
I agree that is the standard in 839, yes.
And then, is that the standard we've applied to nuisance? That in every case there's a duty to abate the nuisance in a reasonable fashion?
If you find that there is a duty, if there's in this case, because we're being asked, this is a nonfeasance claim. They're alleging that there's a duty to act. You wouldn't necessarily have a duty in every case. No, you have to find that there would be an obligation
to act. Pardon? There was a failure to act here. That's the
correct.
Okay, thank you. Well, what about Wally V? Is it a take? In Brown versus Milwaukee Terminal Railway, where the danger results not from the act of the defendant, right? Your client didn't do it, right? But through subsequent changes for which the defendant is not responsible. To hold the defendant liable, it must be shown either that he knew of the danger incident to the maintenance of the subject matter,
or that the dangerous condition existed for a length of time that in the exercise of ordinary care he or she should have discovered and remedied it. Now, your client knew about the hill, right?
That they knew about the hill, Your Honor. They dispute whether the condition that caused the nuisance condition. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's been sufficient evidence to establish that that caused the nuisance condition.
Okay, that's the causation end. But they knew about the hill. They knew that there was water running off it, right?
Yes.
They knew that there was a complaint about it in terms of nuisance, right?
Yes.
So isn't that just at that stage a duty to act?
No, Your Honor, because in this case, the specific topic at issue is surface water, and the duty is defined by the reasonable use rule.
Okay, so what is a duty to act if you can reasonably do so, right? Isn't that the reasonable use rule?
The reasonable use rule provides that if one has, it actually starts with a privilege as opposed to a duty. It allows the development of land for the, and it allows the diversion of some amount of surface water subject to a reasonableness and a standard. So our point is that it stands to reason that that doctrine does not extend to imposing an affirmative obligation to act when you've done absolutely nothing to cause surface water. That takes the established doctrine so far away from what has worked for over 30 years to be so illogical.
I must have missed this. Your position that, are you saying that if you didn't cause it, that ipso facto, there's no liability? In other words, if you didn't create it, I mean cause it. If you didn't create the nuisance, this, you're not saying that, are you?
Well, I'm saying if the condition that caused an additional issue that comes up in this case is whether or not the condition is naturally occurring. And I am saying that if it's a condition that's naturally occurring relating to surface water, in this case, the grade of the land, then no, you would not have any liability.
So that you don't see any cause of action in nuisance for negligence in maintaining a nuisance.
That's correct.
So you see no cause of action for the negligent maintenance of a nuisance. Hmm?
That's correct, Your Honor, in these facts.
Well, I think this was not the normal grade of the land. This had been particularly graded this way. The hill had been put in.
That's apparently true, but it was 13 years before our clients took possession of the property. So we asked the court to look at the question of what's natural from the relative position of our clients 13 years later when the land is completely developed. Also, your decision in Holzbach instructs us on this issue because in that case, the court addressed what was natural as opposed to artificial in the context of a personal injury case. And what the court found is that the apartment complex at issue in that case, the topography of the land surrounding that complex was actually a naturally occurring condition. It's intuitive to all of us, and it happens every day that when construction occurs, there's disturbance of the land. And so that disturbance did happen here, but far removed from our client's involvement. Some four other owners before. So from their perspective, and I think from this court's perspective, it would be fair to treat that hill as a natural condition under today's circumstances.
We've adopted a number of the restatement of torts second that are discussed, for instance, in the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District case. And I think of the restatement torts second 833, which deals with interference with the flow of surface waters. And it says, an invasion of one's interest in the use and enjoyment of land resulting from another's interference with the flow of surface water may constitute a nuisance under the rules stated in 821 to 831. Is that the law in the state of Wisconsin?
That generally states the reasonable use rule, yes, Your Honor.
And then the next one, at least, that the Metropolitan Milwaukee case took us through, or started with, is 822. I don't want to sound too fancy. I want to make sure that I have the stuff in front of me, and I don't want it to be unfair. 822, as you know,
was used in metropolitan Milwaukee, and we've adopted 822 in this state, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so we have no problem with then the definition of 833 in the restatement, and then the elements that are set forth in 822 that have been adopted in this state. Have we adopted 839 in this state?
Well, you certainly applied it in the Milwaukee metropolitan case.
I know. I wonder, do we adopt it, though?
I don't know that you necessarily did. I think it instructed on this the continuing issues that have already been in established law under Brown and Ramsdale and other cases.
Sometimes it's hard to know, isn't it, when it's integral to the analysis, but sometimes we use the magic words of adopting, sometimes we don't.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, so
I see I'm out of time.
Okay. I guess I'll never know the answer.
I'd be glad to answer your question.
Oh, go ahead, answer our question.
I don't recall that this case said that they adopted the statement. I believe it was actually in a footnote. It was largely used in a footnote.
Well, several places, but it was in two footnotes, but also in the text.
Your memory is better than mine. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tutwiler. Ms. Epstein?
May it please the court. My name is Patricia Epstein, and I also represent Charles and Joan O'Rourke, who are here today, and American Family. My goal here will be to focus on the issues of duty and public policy as they relate to this case. And justices, during my opposing counsel's argument, already raised several of the valid public policy concerns at issue here, including the concept that this is a house, a development on a hill with additional homeowners. And I passed a little note to my client here. He told me there are three other homeowners up the hill from him. So on that side of Rowley Street in Dodgeville are four homes, all unfortunately for the Hawkins pointing downwards. And again, that development was created in 1991, and Mr. O'Rourke and his wife moved in the year 2004 when they were promptly notified that they were going to be sued for living on a hill. Today we urge you to affirm the trial court's very well-reasoned decision. That court concluded that under these undisputed facts, liability should not be imposed on innocent landowners, the O'Rourkes here, who, as my co-counsel said, were the fourth owners of this home, and who moved into their retirement home in 2004. They were sued because they are solely on higher ground. That is the basis of the lawsuit. And this court should uphold the trial court's well-reasoned decision, which considered both the scope of duty owed in this circumstance under these facts to exercise ordinary care and public policy considerations, even if one were to assume arguendo that negligence could be proven.
Counsel, I want to focus on the public policy, because what was the public policy of the trial court?
The court was concerned at what imposing liability in this situation would do to the entire real estate market in the state of Wisconsin. We are a hilly state. We are a wet state. We are getting...
We are a great state.
We are a great state. I agree.
My concern is that, I think, blurs the distinction between our six traditional public policy factors that you aptly stated in your brief on page 24, and the idea of what's good policy for this state of Wisconsin, or the good policy for this wet and rainy state is to enhance the development of the real estate market. But that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about public policy, and does policy limit liability. And so I thought that was a problem with the trial court's opinion, that the policy he used wasn't one of the six factors that you set out in page 24.
Well, I think looking at his decision in a broad, comprehensive sort of whole picture approach, that he was addressing the six prongs of the public policy analysis, particularly the reasonable stopping point concept.
Fair enough. I was going to say, hit them for me. He didn't mention, the public policy he mentioned was concerned for development of real estate. But hit which of the six factors you think are implicated here.
I think that arguably all six would be implicated here. one is the injury too remote from the alleged negligence. And remote is not just an issue of geography, as counsel indicated in one of the reply briefs, because they're next door and we sued them, they're next door. Well, what if the house was a little bit further up the hill? Where do we stop in terms of remoteness? So that's one question. Another question is remoteness in time. Again, the O'Rourkes purchased this house in 2004. So remoteness in time, I would say prong one is satisfied. And the justices, this court may pick one out of six or all six, but I'll be happy to address all of them. Prong two, is the alleged injury out of proportion to the culpability? I would argue yes, it most certainly is in this case. The injury here is allegations that there was terrible damage to this home, mold damage, so both property damage and structural issues where this home might need to be taken out, rebuilt, I'm not sure, as well as significant personal injuries, including mold illness, mold-related illnesses. So those are big damages in proportion to what is the culpability of the O'Rourkes. The culpability is living up the hill. So I would say factor two is satisfied. Factor three, that it's too extraordinary that the negligence brings about the harm. I think that's being on higher ground is too extraordinary a basis in this state or anywhere for that matter to stand for that proposition. Number four, would allowing recovery place an unreasonable burden on the defendant homeowner? The answer to that is most clearly yes, and that was described or at least discussed during your questions with Mr. Stombaugh. What are the O'Rourkes supposed to do? Are they supposed to put in a sewer system? Why don't the plaintiffs put in a sewer system? If that's the abatement, the necessary thing, why is the burden on the people who buy this property 13 years later to take these really unreasonable and costly and complex steps? And I don't think that there is such a burden, and that if there were, it would be an unreasonable one. Factor five, that it would open the door for fraudulent recovery. I think the answer to that is yes. It would encourage people who have had basement water or any kind of structural issues with their house, who might be a little bit lower than their neighbors, to sue those neighbors, even if gravity is not the reason for the problem. Perhaps there was poor construction, or perhaps there was a flood event, which we're certainly seeing throughout our state. The whole neighborhood above would theoretically be liable or be sued and brought in. And so I think the answer to, is there a potential for fraudulent actions? I'm not suggesting that is the case here, but I think the answer to that is yes. And then the sixth, and what I think perhaps is the strongest argument for public policy determination, is that there would be no sensible stopping point. Again, if this case is not affirmed, or if the plaintiff appellants are allowed to proceed with this case, then there would be nothing stopping them, despite their counsel's representation, from bringing in the additional homeowners up the hill.
Counselor, is it your position that there wasn't an obligation on your client's part to take any actions in regard to the groundwater, because they were making a reasonable use of their property, and therefore those actions that they intentionally did under the reasonable use doctrine gave them a privilege which perforce got rid of the cause of action that's before us today?
Yes and no, I would answer. The reasonable use doctrine, as Ms. Tutwiler explored, it's a qualified privilege to make use. In this situation, we don't even have use. There's no use of water, so they don't even have a sprinkler system, which I think was pointed out in our briefs. There's no use, but any body of law or doctrine of law that should govern the issue of surface water or stormwater runoff is embodied within the reasonable use doctrine. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but I do believe that our clients did not have an affirmative duty to act. And the courts have treated very differently nonfeasance torts versus malfeasance torts. And in the Hofflander case, this court made clear that the duty to do some active commission to prevent harm to others is not usually within the duty of ordinary care owed to others. And there are many cases, many within the duty to warn context, where that principle has been applied. And in this case, under these set of circumstances, I submit to the court that there was no duty to act affirmatively. There is, of course, always a duty to exercise reasonable or ordinary care. And what the trial court here did, looked at that situation and really was addressing the scope of the duty. Do these homeowners, these innocent purchasers of property, have an affirmative duty to act? What is the scope? And addressing, I think it was Justice Bradley's question about the certification question, I think that's very instructive. One of the questions they asked, or that they sent, if I can find it, well, I will keep going, but what the Court of Appeals looked at was whether they said that the policy factors affect the, thank you, because there are policy issues involved in deciding the scope of the duty imposed in this situation, and I think that's what this court needs to look at. What is the scope of the duty imposed to uphill landowners who have done absolutely nothing to alter surface water?
May I?
Yes, Justice.
Did the Hawkins do something wrong?
We don't contend that they did. We don't know whether they had an obligation to mitigate their own problems. I'm not sure. I certainly am not alleging that the Hawkins did anything wrong at this point in the case.
Well, you alleged that your clients were innocent.
I agree.
Were the Hawkins not innocent?
They may well be innocent as well. And another point worth mentioning, I see my time is up, but may I finish my thought?
Yes, you may.
The Hawkins did have a remedy. They were aware of this problem in 1991 and in the 1990s. They chose to not pursue those remedies that were available to them at that time. And another public policy ground is that we would not want to reward that delay, and I think the court should consider that as well. Thank you.
Do they have a remedy now? If you were representing them right now, what would you say to them?
That's a good question, Justice Prosser. There is an appeal pending as to the city and the engineer and the developer, and I have not focused on that issue. But they certainly had a remedy for some good period of time.
Perhaps Mr. Munt will focus on that issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Mrs. Stoneblum? I'm sorry, Mr. Munt.
May it please the court, my name is Rick Munt. It is my privilege to represent respondent Amy Kruber-Schrank. I want the court to imagine, if you will, that you are a recent property owner, you recently purchased property. You are unaware of any issue with respect to surface water, any concern with respect to surface water on your property or adjoining property owners. During the period of your property ownership, you have neither altered, disturbed, or modified the topography. You have not gardened, cultivated, or tilled. You have done nothing to disturb your property at all. You live up gradient from somebody down gradient. And you find yourself sued by that person who lives down gradient because through the natural course of gravity, carrying water from your property onto theirs, the downgradient property owner claims damages of bodily injury and property damage. You have been sued because the sole basis for the claim liability is your upgradient property ownership and the laws of nature, specifically precipitation and gravity. If you can so imagine, you are now a fellow traveler with my client, Amy Kruber-Schrank, because that is the sole basis upon which she has been brought into this lawsuit by the Hawkins. Fortunately for you, in this state, you are jurisprudentially protected and sheltered, because to this point, we have yet in this state to recognize a cause of action for nuisance or liability based upon those limited facts that I've now recited for you. What the plaintiff's appellants are asking this court to do is extend existing law beyond nuisance, beyond negligence, into what would essentially, in Ms. Kruber-Schrank's situation, be strict liability for property ownership.
Well, it's alleged, as I understand it, that she should have known of the condition. I'm not saying that's true or not. I'm saying that it's alleged that she should have known of the condition because of the nature and extent of it. It's further alleged that she failure to act was unreasonable. That's hardly strict liability.
Let me, if I might, Justice Bradley, address that. The appellants rely upon Section 839, Restatement Second. And I want to talk a little bit, if I can, about that in response to your question, because it directly impacts your question. One of the observations and one of the prerequisites to imposition of liability under Section 839 is knowledge of the nuisance and that the nuisance existed without the Hawkins' consent. And I believe it was highlighted in our brief. We talk about one of the comments to Restatement 839. Specifically, I believe it was Comment J. I'm going to direct it to that again. Comment J to that restatement states, when, however, the condition is created before the possessor acquires the land and comes into possession with the condition then existing, he, in this case she, Ms. Kruber-Schrank, may often reasonably assume the consent of those who are affected. Some notice, complaint, or request to abate the condition may be required before the possessor should know that there is no consent. This statement, I believe, Justice Bradley, assists us in answering your question. The record is quite clear. During the approximately 5 years that Amy Kruber-Schrank owned the property, there was never a word, notice, mention from the Hawkins to Ms. Kruber-Schrank about this condition. If we look to comment J, I think that's quite instructive in addressing your question about whether or not she should have known. Comment J tells us, absent that notice from the Hawkins, it's not expected that she should have known.
What language are you referring to in comment J that says absent notice?
Comment J, when the condition is created before the possessor acquires the land.
That I know, but you ended then with something else that didn't follow from that.
Some notice, complaint, or request to abate the condition may be required before the possessor should know that there is no consent.
Okay, thank you.
If I might, I'm going to continue on with that theme from Section 839 because it's apparent to me that that is the basis upon which the appellants are asking this court to extend existing law. We highlighted this in our brief, and I think it bears repeating. There are several prerequisites that this court has to address in the context of examining potential liability from Ms. Kruber-Schrank that the appellants failed to establish under that basis for their case. 839 speaks of abatable artificial conditions. We highlighted that in our brief, and I want to talk to a couple of those. Justice Bradley and I believe Justice Rogenczak both highlighted, seized upon, whether or not this was abatable. Let me get to that in just a moment. I want to talk for a moment about artificial condition. I believe it was Ms. Tutwiler highlighted for the court that, in fact, we are not, in this case, dealing with what is an artificial condition. Holzbach told us that once property is developed and graded, the resulting topography becomes a natural condition. It is no longer at that point artificial. Artificial surface water condition exists only if the owner created a design system to divert its flow. We don't have that in this case. We have what is a natural condition. The appellants cannot establish that critical prong of 839, and that is to establish an abatable artificial condition. The question also was raised to both appellants and respondents whether or not this was abatable. And I believe Justice Bradley seized upon the testimony or the record that indicates that there are three ways that have been established by the appellant's engineer that this could have been abatable. I think you may have said detention pond. You have my apologies for that. I think that came from our brief. It's actually a retention pond, Justice Bradley.
Well, I'll never That's make that mistake on. Again.
Now you know. Mea culpa on us.
Yeah, mea maxima culpa.
There were three that you seized upon: installation of a storm sewer, construction of retention ponds, and providing the Hawkins with a stormwater collection and drainage system. That is the only record before this court. If you look at, I believe it's comment F, again from section 839, it speaks to a condition is not abatable unless it can be accomplished without unreasonable hardship or expense.
Let me take you to comment D of 839, and that hits the point that I was asking about earlier, and that is that liability is not necessarily based upon the responsibility for the creation of the harmful condition, but upon the fact that they're in control over the land and that they may have the responsibility to do something about it. Do you think that's the correct statement of the law?
The present law in this state?
Yeah.
I do not. And I think the more accurate statement of the law in the case, or the law in this state, is that which is found probably in comment J, which introduces the concept of notice and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
May I continue?
Sure. Other than, I've just read a number of things, and Boyle, and a number of treatises, and they all seem, that's an exaggeration. There's many that indicate that there's negligence in maintaining a, you can be negligent for maintaining a nuisance, even though you did not initially create it.
And again, I'm not going to dispute that, but we still have to go back to the notice and the knowledge and the foreseeability.
Sure, sure, absolutely. But with the prerequisites of notice, you know, of knowledge, that's right, do you believe the law in the state of Wisconsin is that a cause of action can exist for negligently maintaining a nuisance even though you did not create it?
I believe it can. However, I do not believe that is dispositive of the issues before this court with respect to Ms. Kruber-Schrank for the reasons that I previously articulated.
Fair enough. I was just talking different
sure.
scale.
I also want to follow up, if I might, on Section 839, just by way of highlighting the factual record. This property, as the court is aware, was developed in 1991. Ms. Kruber-Schrank purchased it in 1999. 8 years later, she owned it for about 5 years until sometime in 2004. At no point during that 5 years while the Hawkins lived down gradient from her was she ever put on notice by the Hawkins. Was she ever advised by the Hawkins? Was she ever informed by the Hawkins of any concern whatsoever about water accumulation, water runoff, surface water drainage? I want to talk. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mrs. Stonebaum.
I believe there was a significant misstatement with respect to the Holzbach case. That is a Court of Appeals decision. It is not a decision of this court. That was a slip and fall case dealing with an artificial or a natural condition. And the Holzbach case cited by the Builders Association is a Court of Appeals decision in 2005, which dealt with none of the issues that we have here today. With respect to the issues, three homeowners does not create a class action. That is not too difficult of a problem for a circuit court to deal with. And the O'Rourkes were not sued because they are on higher ground. They're sued because they allowed damage to continue even after being warned with respect to the harms during their period of ownership, and that's the only period of ownership they would be responsible for. With respect to remoteness in time, this is a continuing nuisance. The law of Wisconsin is that each and every nuisance is a new nuisance, a continuing one. And when we're talking about the innocent parties, Justice Prosser, it's a well-recognized principle that where a loss must be borne by one of two, it should be borne by the person who occasioned it. That's been the principle of Wisconsin law for more than a century. But with respect to imagine, there is nothing natural about what happened here. I've never seen a natural subdivision in my life. A It did not just appear from nature out of God's hands. It appeared because people changed the topography. My clients were living a bucolic life in the country before this happened without any of these issues. And then it all just started rushing down onto them. But with respect to it, I believe it's a misstatement of the law of Wisconsin to say that she had to have actual notice with respect to it, because this court focused very, very significantly on one issue, constructive notice, in the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage case, in a negligence case. Constructive notice is enough. Had it existed long enough that someone who was paying attention should have seen it and done something about it.
Are there genuine issues of material fact here, and if so,
there are absolutely genuine issues of material fact. Let's look at Alvarado for an example. If the facts of Alvarado call for a complex situation, I can't imagine that this case is less complex than Alvarado. That was a case where someone had their hand blown off by using a firework with a pilot light. But this case involves engineering. It involves the intentionality with respect to making his property absolutely subservient and the sacrificial lamb for the entire project. But what we have here is a very complex situation which calls for a jury to decide whether the actions of the defendants were reasonable in creating this sort of horrible situation for this man and his wife.
But everything you've just discussed would have been in the hands of the developer. The artificial gradients, the lack of the means of diversion of the water, how is it that the respondents could be held liable for that?
Well, Your Honor, you are exactly right with respect to the role of the developer here, but there's a difference between putting a ball in motion and keeping rolling it down the hill, and that's exactly what the defendants in this case did.
How can they keep a ball rolling down a hill if they're not the ones who started it?
Well, it's coming from their property onto our property. We can't stop it, okay, with respect to it. So they keep the ball rolling.
Your clients can't stop it. There's no abatement that your clients could conduct.
Their entire property would be sacrificed with respect to an issue, because you have to understand they are in a bowl right now. There's no way for water, because what happened, if I can just help you to understand this, the upgrade was tremendously increased, but they lifted the street in front of Mr. Hawking's home. Before this, any water passing through would continue on. With this, we have a situation where he's at the bottom of a bowl. They can't even live there anymore. And it's a tremendous financial sacrifice, as you can imagine.
So in your estimation, because of errors made by the developer, the respondents have the job to go back and fix what the developer did.
We are not talking about them fixing. We are talking about them stopping this flowage onto this property, because it's the only thing that we can do with respect to the immediate landowner. That is the only thing. They have the duty of reasonable care. They knew what was happening. Just because they choose to look the other way doesn't absolve them of their continuing issues, because every rainfall is a continuing nuisance. They may have set balls in motion, but people are continuing to allow them to hit us. And that's exactly what's happened. Thank you very much.
Yes, a minute, Mr. Stonebaum.
Explain once more where the other appeal is.
The other appeal is in the Court of Appeals right now. There was an issue that they raised, of course, with respect to the statute of repose. Our position with respect to that was that Mr. Hawking had been told all along that he was, and this is in the decision that's in one of the defendant's appendixes, but he was told all along, we will take care of this and we'll handle it. So he, until they told him, we're not dealing with this and we're not going to help you, that's where he was left. But he was gullible. He believed his government.
Oh. Yes.
At least in that case.
You touched a nerve today.
Sorry about that.
Any other questions? Is the law, thank you, Chief. Is the law in Wisconsin that a person is not using ordinary care and is negligent if the person, without intending to do harm, acts or fails to act under circumstances in which she or he is under a duty to take positive action that a reasonable person would recognize as creating an unreasonable risk of harm or damage to others? Is that the law?
Justice Bradley, that is the blackest of black letter law in this state.
What is the circumstance in which the defendant is under a duty to take positive action. What duty is there to take positive action here?
The duty is when the defendant realizes or should know in the exercise of reasonable care or has constructive notice of believing the decisions such as Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage, that this is a problem that needs to be dealt with, and you just can't let it continue to flow under those circumstances. So yes, it's a problem, and it was obvious to anyone who was looking. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stumbaugh. Thank you, Ms. Tuttweiler and Ms. Epstein and Mr. Munt, for your arguments today in this private nuisance case. That concludes our hearing in 07 AP 1754, Hocking versus City of Dodgeville. The students who can remain should remain, and we'll have Justices Crooks and Gableman come out and talk with you. Anyone else who wishes to be in that conversation may stay. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:15. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 for a second set of oral arguments.